discipline, Rush Limbaugh is a big fat idiot. Sorry. And he's gone on to do several other books that we all know and love. But this fall, there is a new one coming out by Dutton. His publisher is Dutton, and he is coming forward with a book called Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, a fair and balanced view of the right. Ladies and gentlemen, Al Franken.
Thank you. Thank you. Here's here's the preliminary cover of Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, a fair and balanced look at the right. And Bill, we talked about this before. The picture of you, if we can get one from the factor, it'd be great. Because he wasn't happy with this one, and this is a public domain picture, and just any picture of you with your mouth open would be good. We were asked what inspires about to write this book. Actually, God asked me to write this book because he was so pissed off at Bush, who claimed whose friends claimed that he had been chosen by God, and God said actually he hadn't. It was chosen by Clarence Thomas. It was an interesting process with this book. I was asked to be a fellow at the Kennedy School, where you're a graduate, and they at the Shorenstein Center, and they asked me to be a fellow there. I said, "What do I have to do?" And they said, "Nothing, but write something." And I said, "Well, you don't want me to teach anything?" I said, "Well, you can have a study group and teach something there." So I had a study group of 14 great kids from the Kennedy School and undergraduates, and I taught them to research my book. Basically, the book starts as a response to Bernie Goldberg and Ann Coulter about this myth of a liberal bias in the media. And kind of the premise of the whole book, the start of the book, is that asking whether there is a liberal or conservative bias in the mainstream media is like asking if the problem with Al-Qaeda is that they use too much oil in their hummus. The problem with Al-Qaeda is they want to kill us. The biases of the mainstream media there are many, many biases in sensationalism, horse race, get it first, do it cheap. There's just so many more important biases, and the idea that there's a liberal bias in the media that is just ridiculous. All you have to do is like look at the coverage of Clinton. I mean, especially during the Monica thing, it was 24/7 Monica, and there were some news organizations that did not succumb to that temptation. I like to cite them wherever I go. Sailing Magazine. American Grocer Monthly. Jugs. And Big Butt. Which is ironic, because I thought Big Butt, had a story. And then if you look at the 2000 campaign, the idea that there was a bias on behalf of Gore is ridiculous. Remember in the one of the debates, Gore said that he had gone to Texas to go to a disaster with James Lee Witt, the head of FEMA. It turned out he hadn't gone to that disaster with James Lee Witt. He went with a deputy of James Lee Witt. He went to 17 other disasters with James Lee Witt, not that one. Press jumps all over him. He's a liar. It was as if James Lee Witt was the most popular man in America, and Gore was lying just to get some of that James Lee Witt magic, to rub off on him. Another one of the 2000 debates, Bush says this, and this is a quote. "By far, the vast majority of my tax cut goes to those at the bottom." by far, a vast majority of my tax cut goes to those at the bottom. Nothing from the press. Not a thing. And is it because they have a conservative bias? I don't think so. I think their attitude was, he doesn't know. I mean, he doesn't know. Leave him alone. He doesn't know. And so now we have this new tax cut, and every tax cut, of course, is going to the people at the top, and Bill has supported all of those tax cuts. And they'll do great. First of all, on the economy. Let me talk a little one thing about the economy. This is, I love statistics because they never lie. Numbers never lie. In the 6 years plus the two Bushes have been president, there have been actually negative net jobs. Not one new net job has been created. Extrapolating on that, if the Bushes had headed this country from the very beginning, our country's inception, to the present time, not one American would have ever worked. Not one. So, you know, they do this sometimes. They still say it, that the bottom gets the biggest tax cut. Look, someone making $26,000 gets their taxes 100% tax cut. All their income taxes are cut by this. 100% tax cut. Well, of their income tax. And maybe they're paying $200 in income tax. And, oh, Dick Cheney, he's only getting an 8% cut. Gee, look, 100% cut for the waitress. And only an 8% cut for Dick Cheney. Which is like $1 million or $500,000, whatever it is.
$100,000.
Thank you, Mike. Sometimes I overstate. But this person making $26,000, maybe a single mother, going to lose her Medicaid, going to lose her Medicaid for her kids, is going to pay more than in state taxes because their states are in terrible shape. The kids are going to have, there's going to be less money going to the schools. Kentucky's releasing prisoners. I mean, this is crazy what we're doing. And this huge, huge deficit. Remember, Bush said when we first went in the deficit with him, he said, well, I said during the campaign that, you know, the only way we go into deficit is if we had a recession, a national emergency, or war. Well, I guess I hit the trifecta, right? Remember he said that? Except, you know what? He didn't say that during the campaign. Washington Post looked back, he never said it. One person did say it was Al Gore. Bush, not great with language. Evildoers, for example. Remember when he first started using evildoers? And the rest of the administration felt they had to use evildoers, too? It was really fun to watch, like, Dick Cheney have to slip in evildoers. It was like, this is not a war against Islam. This is an effort to eradicate the... evildoers. So there's no... The mainstream media does not have a bias. Left or right. There is, however, a right-wing media, and we know who they are. The Wall Street Journal editorial page. Talk radio, which talks so eloquently about Bill. Fox. Fair and balanced. Talk about Orwellian. I mean, come on. And I think they go back into the, create an echo effect in the media. And as a result, I think the whole media has moved to the right. Now, I answer a couple of books. Then that's part of the right-wing media, too. And I know that you publishers are going to start publishing more right-wing books for... you know, the bulk sales so that Richard Mellon Scaife can, you know, use Mona Charon's books for mulch. But Ann Coulter's book, I write a chapter on Ann Coulter, and she brags about having 752 footnotes. And actually, she has no footnotes. She has endnotes. There's a difference, because you don't check the endnotes. Especially, I think, her readers, or she at least depends on that. For example, let me quote from her book. After Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas wrote an opinion contrary to the clearly expressed position of the New York Times editorial page, the Times responded with an editorial on Thomas titled "The Youngest, Cruelest Justice." That was actually the headline on a lead editorial in the newspaper of record. Thomas is not engaged on the substance of his judicial philosophy. He is called a colored lawn jockey for conservative white interests, race traitor, black snake, chicken and biscuit eating Uncle Tom, house Negro and handkerchief head, Benedict Arnold and Judas Iscariot, all this from the tireless opponents of intolerance. Now, what percentage of her readers think that the New York Times, from this paragraph, called Clarence Thomas a chicken and biscuit eating Uncle Tom? I'll bet you like 99%. Well, this isn't from the New York Times. She endnotes them, and then you have to go back and find, oh, I see, this was a Playboy interview with somebody. Or, oh, I see, this was an SCLC conference. She does this all the time. Also, I'm kind of an expert on it because in a New York Observer article, she said that we were friendly. I had met her once, and I guess I made the mistake of not just saying to her, "You're horrible. I hate you." And instead, I was cordial, so therefore I showed up as one of her friends. So in my book, I have a little thing. I say, even people Coulter consider friends says she's a lying bitch, one. A horror show of epic proportions, two. Oh, the poor thing, and a bitch. And then the notes are on the bottom of the page, footnotes. One was me and my wife. Two is Ibid. Oh, the poor thing is my wife to me. the fourth is to another friend. I don't want to run over my time, but the book is very wide-ranging, and it gets into a lot of things. And one of whom, and I know you don't like name-calling, and I know that you say you retract everything, but I do have Bill on the cover, and I want to just justify it, okay? Can I borrow your water? No? Molly? You're out? Thanks.
Thank you. Taste it first.
Yeah. Because I really need to tell this right. Okay, and Bill, you know a little bit of this story. A couple years ago, I'm watching C-SPAN, which I love to watch. And I see Bill promoting his book, No Spin Zone. And he's on, it's a format like this, actually. It's a moderator, just with him, though. And he says, the moderator says something like, you hosted Inside Edition, which was a tabloid show. And Bill says, tabloid show, we won two Peabody's. And the guy said, well, yeah, but you got to admit, it was kind of a tabloid show. And he goes, Peabody's only the most prestigious award in journalism. We won two of them. The guy says, well, yeah, but it had kind of a tabloidy format. And he says, you want us to give our two Peabody's back? So I'm watching this, and I'm going like, Inside Edition never won a Peabody. So I nexus Peabody and Inside Edition. And I do get three hits, and they're all Bill saying on his show that Inside Edition had won the Peabody. Here's one from August 30th. I anchored a program called Inside Edition, which has won a Peabody Award. There it won one. May 8th, you won two. Well, all I've got to say is that Inside Edition has won, I believe, you did qualify it, two Peabody Awards, the highest journalism award in the country. And then on May 19th, 2000, you go into this long thing about, someone says it's Neville, says... he says, you hosted Inside Edition. You say, correct, which is a tabloid show. You say, by whom? By many people. Does that mean? And then you say, we throw the Peabody Awards back. We won Peabody Awards. So I go to the Peabody website and look for Inside Edition Peabody Awards, and there aren't any. And I called the Peabody people, and I said, did you guys give Inside Edition a Peabody? And there was some laughter. And, you know, because I'm thinking, what was it for, you know, How Bare Is Too Bare, or, you know, something on Madonna's first, you know, the father of her first baby, maybe you won it for. But they say, no, they've never won it. So I call Bill, and you were really nice. You called me back. And you said, yeah, what is it, Al? And it was very warm. And I said, I saw you on C-SPAN. You said you won Inside Edition 1-2 Peabody's. Well, we did. I said, well, you really should talk to the Peabody people about that, because they don't think you did. And he said, I'll call you back. Calls me back 5 minutes. You remember this? He says, it was a poke. I say, a poke? He said, yeah. It's just as prestigious as the Peabody. I said, so there are two most prestigious awards in journalism. He says, Al, it's very, very prestigious. I said, well, okay, don't you think it's odd that you got it wrong about a journalism award? And he says, Al, if you want to go after me, go ahead. So I say, okay. So I call the Washington Post. I call Lloyd Grove at the Washington Post, and I tell him the whole thing, and he calls Bill, and Bill says Al has a jihad against me or something, so I got a poke. Now, Bill, see, I had sort of expected Bill to go, gee, Al, thanks for pointing this out. Boy, is that embarrassing. Woo! Boy, I don't want to make that mistake again. No, but it was, go ahead, go after me. So, Bill in the thing acknowledges making a mistake, so big deal. You go on your show and say big deal. About a few weeks later, a columnist from Newsday picks it up and says, writes a column called Not All the Facts on the Factor of Facts or something like that. And then you do a little special thing. You're out with Michael Wolff and on attack journalism. It's your... you introduce a personal story segment on attack journalism. This is a personal to me because some writers are really violating every tenet of fairness in what they're saying in print about your humble servant. And then you say, I'll give you an example. Guy says about me a couple weeks ago, O'Reilly said he won a Peabody Award. Never said it. See, this is why you don't retract things, because you just continue. You can't find a transcript where I said it. You know, there is no one on earth you could bring in that would say I said it. Robert Reno in Newsday, a columnist, writes in his column, calls me a liar, all right? And it's totally fabricated. That's attack journalism. It's dishonest, it's disgusting, and it hurts reputations. Wolf, the media critic from the New York Magazine, says it's also incorrect journalism if it's wrong. It's wrong. Okay, well, then the guy made a mistake. Now, come on. He made a mistake. That's... lives forever in Nexus. And he did write a column, and did he write a column the next day saying he made a mistake? Well, obviously you should. Usually I find if someone made a mistake, if you ask them to correct it, they do correct it. Not in this society anymore. So, Bill, I'm sorry I call you one of the many people who do lie in my book. And I guess we're going to have some question and answer, so you have a chance to respond to that. And there's others. I mean, you know, it goes on and on. And there are so many other people on the right who do it too, and they'll be enumerated in the book, and it's important. And it's really important. And it's important because we've been just taking it. We have been taking it and taking it on the left. You know, I went to that Wellstone memorial. The next day I hear Rush Limbaugh on the radio going, there was no memorializing, my friends. They distorted that thing. I do a case study of that thing. They distorted that memorial so badly. And I wish Tucker were here today, because Tucker the next day said that Republican senators who'd come, who were friends of Wellstone, were shouted down by the crowd when they tried to speak. That wasn't the format of the memorial. There was lie after lie. Weekly Standard Christopher Caldwell did the most vicious thing on that, on the Wellstone Memorial, did not see it. All he saw, I think, were some clips on Fox that Mr. Hannity had put together. So I got this chapter and verse, and I got it. And we're not going to sit for it anymore. We just aren't. Okay, I'll finish for now. I could go on all day.
I know you could.
And I know you could.
You just about have. You just about have.
Yeah, you tell him, Bill.
We're supposed to be on here for 15 minutes. This idiot goes 35, okay? All he's got in 6.5 years is that I misspoke, that I labeled a Polk Award a Peabody. He writes it in his book. He tries to make me out to be
No.
Hey, shut up. You had your 35 minutes. Shut up.
This isn't your
this is
show,
what this guy
Bill.
Does.
Bill,
this is
you
what
can
he
tell
does.
Me. You can't
This is what he
Take
does.
Take control, Pat. Come on.
Hey. I think I need a whistle and a strike.
Sure.
Yeah, not to be a referee.
Maybe I went on long enough.
Can you please control him? This guy accuses me of being a liar, ladies and gentlemen, on national television. Because I misspoke and labeled a Peabody a Polk. I didn't mention we won four national headliners, okay? This is what this guy does. He demonizes it, all right? And then other people pick it up. Now, if it's important to you that I misspoke and labeled a Peabody
you
a
Polk,
didn't
just misspeak.
That's fine. That's fine, okay? This is what he does. He's a vicious, and that is with a capital V, person who is blinded by ideology. And that's all I'll say about Peabody.
Okay. Thank you very much. Right. And I think what we need to do...
I want to have my opinion.
Is reclaim all of this. The one thing I want to say to the wonderful booksellers in this room. If your customers tell you that there isn't a variety of books coming out this fall, your customers aren't paying attention. Because I must say, I think we have shown here this tremendous range. And I think one of the things that all of us stand for, booksellers and publishers, very vigorously, is free speech and freedom of expression. I hope we don't take this personal. And I think at this point, what we really need to do is find a way that we're going to have some questions and see if we can do this. So wish me luck. And if anybody does have a whistle and any of those signals for
Pat,
piling on or something, I'm ready. But
Pat, can
Molly,
I just put in
we'll
a brief response
to
those speakers? I just want to note that the Polk is an extremely prestigious journalism award. But that my normal journalistic standards, you owed a correction on that one.
Yeah, we did.
By the way, the Polk, I'm sorry, Molly, but the Polk that they won was won a year after Bill left the show.
The discussion was about the program. I said nothing that I won anything. It was a discussion on the program.
Then why did you use the pronoun we?
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Okay.
I also wanted,
Wait a minute.
Just to say a couple of other things. In our ongoing efforts to achieve civil discourse, one of the things that I notice is that we do tend, and I know Bill specifically says he tries not to do this, but we do tend to lump everybody, you know, the left, the right, and then accuse the left says this or that. And it's interesting to me because what I keep saying to people is, I ain't the left, I ain't populism, my name is Molly Ivins. And when I write about the issue of possibly no weapons of mass destruction, the first thing I note is I have no way in hell of knowing whether or not there are any WMDs over there. The other thing that I wanted to respond to is the idea that Bill specifically said he wants there to be WMDs because it's important for the country. It would be a terrible loss of credibility if we don't find them, about which he's absolutely correct. There's a point I want to make about that because there's an implication that people who opposed this war did so for any reason other than that we thought it would be terrible for the country. What I did before the war was predict a short, easy war and the peace from hell. And so far, I think I'm 2 for 2. I didn't want us to go into Iraq, not because I didn't understand that Saddam Hussein was a miserable son of a bitch. I've been active in human rights work for 35 years. I knew he was a miserable son of a bitch when the Reagan administration was sending him weapons. And I said from the beginning that you could make a case for going in on humanitarian grounds alone. But that's not the case the Bush administration made. And the only reason I opposed going in after him is because I was terribly afraid that this country would get caught in an awful quagmire over there. And the only reason I opposed it is because I love this country. Thank you.
Bill, I would be interested in your and Molly having a discussion about her concept of Doug Jones, because in a way, you're talking about who's looking out for you, so you're talking about a Doug Jones, too.
The difference between Ms. Ivins and myself is that I don't believe the government can help you all that much in your life, all right? I don't believe that all of the big government programs that are set up to benefit the folks, most of them never get to the folks. I was a high school teacher. I know that money goes. It doesn't go to the kids. And you want more money? Fine. It ain't going to the kids. It's discipline. It's structure. It's paying the teachers a better wage. It's training the teachers better. All of those things. So I see the world as a world that self-reliance matters. That's what should be taught. All right? That's where I'm coming from. You know, we talk about the tax and the deficit. Well, you know, the left now is screaming, the deficit, the deficit, the deficit. And I'm looking at them going, look, you guys were driving the big government programs ever since the Great Society of 1964. I mean, those were massive spending programs, many of which failed dismally. And the corruption here in California, for example, in the Medi-Cal program is astronomical. It's a giant waste. Safety net, yes. Nanny state, no. All right? And I don't believe in income redistribution. All right, I don't believe in taking money from me, all right, who started out.
Oh, no, wait a minute. It's just
started out with nothing, all right, and then giving to somebody else and not regulating what that person does with it. I just don't believe that. Now, I respect other people who believe opposite from me, and I listen to them and evaluate their argument. But from my life's eye, I don't see that as being effective. I believe in drug testing for welfare. I believe in personal responsibility across the board. So that's where I'm coming from in the Dub Jones argument, all right? I'm coming from this society needs to be trained in self-reliance and responsibility.
Okay, I think that's a perfectly legitimate point of view, and listen to it with great respect. Again, we have this problem, though, that my name is Molly Ivins. I never went around saying big government programs were wonderful. I don't know who you think I am, but I'm not, you know, liberals. My name is Molly Ivins. It says in the preamble of the Constitution that there are 6 purposes and functions of government. One is to improve the general welfare. I myself have always thought that meant mostly health and education. And it seems to me we are still in this country not in doing a very good job on either one. And in fact, there is considerable evidence that the entire healthcare system is not just showing cracks, it is literally falling apart. I mean, the bricks are coming out of it. And what you will see after this round of state budget cuts, I've just finished covering the legislative session in Texas, which, of course, involved being embedded with the troops in Ardmore, Oklahoma. They cut $9 billion out of a budget that was never generous. Believe me, Texas state government is not some wasteful operation. And they cut it all out of programs that help poor people. Now, I'm fine with, open competition, but I'm a great believer in the equal starting line. I don't want equal results. I don't want everybody to end up in the same place in life. Those who work harder and are more talented, you all go on and soar. But I want an equal starting line.
You're never going to have an equal starting line.
You can work to get there.
And I write about this in Who's Looking Out for You? It's the first chapter. You will never have it because some kids have good parents and Some kids have drug-addicted parents and alcoholic parents because some kids are born with more gifts and some left. Less gifts. You will never have it. It's impossible for the government to
impose it. Yeah, but why not keep working at it?
You can work at it, but you have to work at it under a very disciplined structure. And I believe that. I believe that the government can provide that structure, but will not, because we live in this age of political correctness that's just through the roof. But one of the interesting things about the dovetailer theory is that the middle class and working Americans get squeezed to death, and that's true. But why are they getting squeezed to death? Three reasons. Under President Clinton, Americans paid the highest taxes since World War II, state, local, and federal. All right? The tax burden on someone like me, all right, and migrant, went over 50% in New York State and in California as well. But the people who were making between $50,000 and $80,000, their tax burden hovering around 40%. That's 40 cents on the dollar taken away from them. Yet real estate prices to buy a home in this state, in Southern California here, or in my state in New York or Massachusetts or Chicago or anywhere where people cluster to make them, have gone right crazy, so that the mortgage takes way more money than it took from my parents. And then the educational costs if you send your kids to college. The three combine to make the average American in debt. So I'm saying the more money that you have to control in your life, the better it is. And that the government had, Bush makes his mistake in the sense that he wants to cut taxes, but he won't impose discipline on the Pentagon, for example, where $1 trillion has been misappropriated, not stolen. They don't know where it is. There's a guy named David Walker, the head of the GAO. He's a really good guy. He's one of the best public servants in the United States of America. They call Walker in, and Ms. Schroeder knows this because she was on these committees. And the Pentagon cannot account right now for $1 trillion. $1 trillion. They don't know where it is. That's the fallacy of the Bush administration. They won't impose the discipline. So when the money is allotted to the education or the Pentagon or whatever it is, that it's run like a private company, that you have to go back to the stockholders and say, here's where the money went.
Okay, wait a minute. I really have to jump in here. The idea that private corporations are more efficient than government is absolute crap.
Well, that's wrong. Now we part ways. Now we part ways.
There is something that economists are now studying, which is as a result of Enron, WorldCom, et cetera. It's called control fraud, when the fish rots from the head down, which is what happened at Enron. There's a whole chapter in our book about that. The idea that a government, the private, why do you think the Pentagon is so screwed up? It's all private defense contractors with endless cost overruns. It's the $700 hammer.
Right, and nobody imposes discipline, says don't do that. You can't do that. You're absolutely right on that.
Private defense contractors are pulling that shit off.
That's not just in the defense industry. It's in the poverty industry. It's in the educational industry. It's across the board.
Am I being punished?
No. No, no. I'm sorry.
I wanted also to respond
I just thought we'd have a Doug Jones argument over
okay,
here.
Okay, no. I'm enjoying the debate. But I can actually participate in it.
I wanted also to respond on the economic argument. I do believe in income redistribution to this extent. Look at this current tax situation. 50% of the people in this country are now paying more in payroll taxes than they are in income taxes.
That's 80%.
Thank you. When the Bush administration discusses tax distribution, all they talk about is income tax. They totally misrepresent the actual tax burden on people in this country. We quote a guy named B. Rappaport, who's rather an unusual Texas millionaire, and what he says, if you're making $50,000 a year, you're paying $8,000 in income taxes. That even puts you in the poorhouse, but it will sure as hell crimp your budget. I make $1 million a year. I pay $400,000 in taxes. That leaves me with $600,000 to live on. You going to feel sorry for me?
You deserve your money. You earned your money, all right? And you want to take money from people who have earned the money, all right? And you want to give it to other people.
Now, what
you
this
cannot
is what,
point to any constitutional
I don't want to
provision
give it to other
that
people.
Says, look, if you want a socialistic quasi-socialistic state. Let's have a referendum.
I don't
Let's
want
to vote
give it,
on it.
I
but don't take
give
private
it to
property
people.
Away from people
okay.
and give it to other people.
Okay. Okay. Wait a minute.
Al, this is way over your head here. All right.
Go back. We'll call you when we need you. Go back over there.
Unlike Molly, I am a liberal. And the idea that government programs can't help people is ridiculous. And I'll give you a story. I mean, you like to say you came from the poorest background possible. You've said that.
No, I haven't.
Yes, you have.
From a working class Levittown.
You said
background.
From the.
It's another distortion.
Did you grow up in Westbury or Levittown?
The Westbury section of Levittown, all right, which I've defined 87 times because on the A&E bio, you know, we'll send it.
By the way,
why don't you come over to my house? My mother lives there. Come on over. We'll have a bagel, all right?
Okay,
come
great.
On over.
I would love that.
Mrs. O'Rourke, too.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example, though, and I don't think my wife will mind because I'm writing about it in the book. When my wife, should I move back to the thing? Is this? Okay. I was just trying to get in here. There are a couple things I can talk about. I mean, when you say I'm way, this is above me, I remember being on your show and saying that in 93, Clinton had passed his budget deficit reduction act without one Republican vote, and you said, Al, that's impossible. And I said, no, he did it without one Republican vote. And you didn't understand, I guess, at the time, that both houses were Democrat. And both, you know, so this isn't way over my head. Okay?
All right, we'll give you an honorary PhD. Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. Anyway.
Any questions out there? Any questions from the folks out here?
Oh, wait
you guys
a minute.
Want to know anything?
Did Bill just cut me off?
Al, you had 45 minutes up here.
Oh, no, 45.
No.
At least seem that way.
It always seems longer when none of us have the microphone, I know, but it really wasn't.
Can I finish just about my wife's story? When my wife was 18 months old, her father died in a car accident. Her mother was 27 with five kids, one younger than my wife. They made it scrape by. My mother-in-law didn't have an education. She worked in a grocery store in the produce department. She made it barely scrape by because of Social Security from her husband. They got the house on the GI loan. They turned the phone off a lot. They turned the heat off a lot. They lived in Portland, Maine. But the government saved their ass. And this is, you know what, this is actually serious, this stuff. And the fact is, when Clinton, you know, you may remember that in the 90s, during Clinton, he raised the top level. And it didn't stop people who were in the top 1% from working or producing jobs. He created 23 million jobs. And every Republican said that was going to cause a recession. And you remember, it didn't actually pass with any Republican votes. Not one. Okay.
Well, all right. So maybe let me say about all of this. This has been the last week was a very good week for me because as the author of The Family Medical Leave, the Supreme Court upheld it 6-3 with Rehnquist on my side. I never thought that would happen. So one of my great hopes for the planet is if we all keep talking together, maybe we'll figure this all out. And I think it is very difficult. It's a very difficult time, I think, for everybody to try and figure out what's going on. But I think it's only
not
fair
that, hard.
That we open it up to the audience, because they may have some viewpoints out here. Do we have anybody who is not shy? There's someone over here in a gray suit.
The question is the redistricting fight that drove the Texas legislators to seek refuge in Oklahoma, a great moment in the history of our state. I've been covering the legislature for a long time, and I've seen some strange maps before. I've seen districts that look like giant chickens and districts that look like coiled snakes. I remember one time during a redistricting fight, an old boy named Guy Floyd stood up and said to the chairman, Delwyn Jones, Delwyn, Look at here what you have done to my district. Got a great big old ball on one end and runs in a little bitty old strip for 300 miles. It's got a great big old ball on the other end. Now, the courts say the districts have to be compact and contiguous. Is this your idea, compact and contiguous? Delwyn thought about it for a moment and said, well, in an artistic sense, it is. And the map produced by Tom DeLay, and that's exactly who produced it, was artistic to the max. It was sort of in the Salvador Dali school of art. Really a stunning piece of work. And I really do think that I know it sounds picky and petty because the whole thing is ludicrous. Nothing in Texas ever happens. I mean, serious stuff happens with very serious implications, but it always happens with this weird hitch in the get-along. And you just have to accept that Texans are always going to, you know, be producing ridiculous goddamn stuff. I mean, it just always happens down there. Ann Richards says, you know, the price of gas in Texas has got so high, women who want to run over their husbands have to carpool now. But there is a very serious point. Not only do the Republicans have no right to come back and ram a new redistricting map down anybody's throat at this point. I mean, listen, once a decade for this horror is enough. And the second point is that during the search for the missing legislators, a truly epic effort, DeLay called the FAA and the Justice Department about trying to track them down, and apparently our state police got the Department of Homeland Security, which is supposed to be tracking down terrorists, to try and find one of the plane that was involved. Well, you know, using government resources for partisan political purposes is really serious stuff. I mean, I realize it's a petty and absurd escapade, but that's really pretty serious stuff. And I just also wanted to say that as far as we know, redistricting is now dead. They may, unless they're forced into a special session, and at which point I think Governor Goodhair would put it back on. And let me say I call him Goodhair because Governor Perry has a head of hair that every Texan can be proud of, regardless of party.
Very good. Anybody else have a question? There's one over here, this gentleman.
Yeah, this is a question for Al Franken. I heard a while back you were working with Anshel Media to try to get a liberal talk show format to counterbalance the controlling conservative talk show format in the corporately owned stations, which is even more important now because of the news with the corporations buying out multiple radio stations. Can you give us an update on those efforts?
Yeah, we're trying to get a liberal or progressive radio network together, and it's I want to do it. And if we can get enough, I want to fail big. So we want to try to get enough funding together to have a huge failure. No, I think there's an audience out there, and I'm dying to do it. And the more I research this book, and the more I look at, and I'm sorry if I made this seem like the book's not, there's only one little chapter on Bill. But there are much more than the one. You'll really be interested in the book, Bill. But there's Bush stuff. I mean, there's just, you know, just stuff that every day, not every day, but Bush will show up at a children's hospital, say that this is so important what we're doing, and then the next day cut funding. And he does that over and over and over again. And there were so many lies in the 2000 campaign. Remember, this was the gutted military. This was the hollowed out military. The military, Bush in his acceptance speech said, if they were asked to report, two units of the Army would have to say, two whole divisions would have to say, not ready for duty, sir. And, of course, they were. And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs said they were. Not only that, but Richard Armitage, in testimony in the Armed Services Committee a few days later, said, well, yeah, they are. And I went up at the White House Correspondents' Dinner to Paul Wolfowitz, and I said, didn't the Clinton military do a great job in Iraq? And he said, F you. And then we had a little argument. I think he was kidding on the square on the F you. I thought he was being funny, and I appreciated that. But Cheney said in 91, after the Gulf War, that any president fights with the military given to him by his predecessor.
Come on.
And he said the first call he made after the Gulf War was done was to President Reagan to thank him.
So the point now, is, Al, that people lie in campaigns? Is that the point? I'm shocked.
No, it's that they lie when they're in office and they continue to lie, and that also that it doesn't get out. It doesn't. It isn't fair and balanced.
It isn't.
And what we want to do, what I want to do is be able, you know what? I'll tell you what. Talk about fair and balance. When you edit this together, I know you're going to show this for the, to the Factor audience. Can I be in the edit room with you to help, you know, kind of, because I would,
you know, look,
I would love the C-SPAN audience.
We were doing a propaganda show. I'd put you in the editing room. You're a genius at that. You're the best propagandist I've ever seen. But if you even people who agree with you in this room, okay, they can't possibly think that you're objective, that you're looking at life to be fair, to come to a fair conclusion. Sure, the Bush and Cheney people told lies, but Clinton Gore didn't tell any lies? Did you miss the Jim Lehrer interview, Al? Come on.
Yeah, I think
if you make a nice living being a propagandist, and more power to you.
Now,
but don't put yourself up as a truth teller because you're not.
Well, here's the thing. I am, though. That's the difference between you and me. In the Rush Limbaugh is a big fat idiot, and other observations, I wrote a book on Rush, and it was a way to get at the Gingrich right. And not one fact was challenged in that book. There was
Nobody read the book, Al. Nobody's going to challenge you. I didn't read the book. Rush Limbaugh's a big fat idiot.
It was number one.
$20 to see that? Come on. You're preaching to the choir. That's what you do.
No. Even John Fund, the guy who ghost wrote Rush's first book, came to me and said, you did a really good job. There was one thing, as I quoted a Kathleen Hall Jameson study in my thing, which was in its preliminary phase, and the findings of that changed after the thing came through. But I'm telling you, I have this thing is thoroughly researched. And I do tell the truth. And when I and if I do get caught, or if I do say something wrong, I admit it. And the whole point of what I said here was that when you were caught, you
look. If this is all you got. We heard it, Al. If this is all you got after 6.5 years.
No, I told you it isn't
you're
all
pathetic.
I have.
If this is all you got after six
I
and a half years,
I told you it isn't
you
all
are
I got.
Pathetic.
It isn't all
idea.
I got. I got a lot more.
And if it's as lame as that, it's unbelievable.
I have a wonderful idea. I'm going to ask the publishers of all three of these authors
to have a
please
party?
Send complimentary books to each author. And I'd love
I'd gladly read Miss Ivan's book. I'd gladly read it.
Well, no, but I think you ought to read all. We'll have a little reading lesson here and see where we all come out at the end. Do we have time for one more or not? One more, she says. Okay.
Bill, I think it'll help sales if you talk about my book on your show.
Okay. You get the last question, you lucky soul.
Well, I want to thank all the speakers for a lively lunch.
Yes.
You know, it strikes me that this dialogue is good entertainment. But at another level, it actually is of some concern to me for our republic. And that is the difficulty of trying to get people to come together and have an effective discourse that really, as a result of the discourse, brings people together more than spreads them apart. And I would really like to hear a brief comment from each of you of what you think might be something constructive that you might do to help a discourse that could bring the differing views of this country together versus split them further apart?
I'll take that first. I work with political humor a lot because I find that if you can get people to start by laughing about something, it sort of clears out the cobwebs in their mind, and they focus on whatever you have to say without the distraction of whatever it was they were thinking of before, which according to studies of college students is sex in 95% of the cases. I have worried about the poisoning of the well of public discourse considerably myself. And to the extent that I'm known as a mean writer, I just want to point out that I only take shots at politicians. I realize they have wives and mothers, but no one ever held a gun to their heads and forced them to run for public office, and as far as I'm concerned, they are all in a free fire zone. Civilians, I never bother with. The meanness of political discussion today, there are lots of villains. I mean, it's not just Rush Limbaugh, and it's not just, whoever you want to name. There is a nastiness about it, and I was really appalled to see Grover Norquist, who's an extremely well-known figure on the right, in the what they call the movement, people who call themselves movement conservatives. And he said that their goal was to bring Washington-level vituperation and partisanship to state houses around the country. Their saying is that bipartisanship is like being seduced. I mean, they have an ugly way of saying it. To find somebody actually saying, we want more anger, we want more, hatred expressed. When you talk to people who get so angry about politics that their faces turn red and their veins stand out on their necks and they shake their wattles like a turkey gobbler, they're just so angry about it. You just want to go, most real politicians are far less passionate than that.
Whenever you have money and power, you're going to have strife. And through the years of our republic, we've always had very, very contentious debate in the political realm because power is a seducer. It's something that people will sell their souls for. So is money, so is sex. So that people like me and Ms. Ivins, who are basically news analysts, we analyze what happens and from my point of view, what I try to do is look out for you. In a sense, I try to look, this is the issue. Here's what I think about it, and here's how I've arrived at my conclusion. When I said in the beginning, I'm trying to convince you to think like me, but I'm trying to give you a perspective that's clear. I can't bring people together. It's not my job, all right? It's not what I do. My job is, unfortunately, to rattle cages, to put the bad guys on alert that here we come, all right? And you better shape up. You better stop doing or start doing better, all right? So there's no way on earth that I can advance the cause of people coming together. But you need people like me. You need watchdogs. And one of the reasons the O'Reilly Factor has been successful in publishing on radio and on television is because we are not timid. For years, the network news, the standardized network news and CNN were too afraid to do what we do. Too afraid. There were no commentators on their they were aligned to Sunday morning. They wouldn't go after the sacred cows, both the Republicans and the Democrats. They wouldn't even give voices to pro-life people unless they blew up an abortion clinic. All right? So it was a stranglehold. That's broken down now. It's broken down all across the board. There are as many left voices as right voices in the media. You can get NPR. You can get Rush Limbaugh. You can get what you want to get. But at my level, and I think Ms. Ivins is in print, pretty much does what I do. We have to make judgments, and these judgments are harsh, and these judgments have to be sold in a way that arouses people's ire, or things will never get better. So that's what I am. I'm a watchdog, a populist watchdog. I'm looking out, trying to make everybody's life better and give you ammunition where you can fight the charlatans, you can fight the people who are hurting you.
Al.
I consider myself a nice guy. And I don't like vituperation, but I feel sometimes you have to stand up and fight. And I feel like there is, I think one of the reasons that Fox beats CNN, for example, is that CNN tries to play things down the middle, and there's a certain dullness to it. And there's a certain, you know, I mean, Roger Ailes invented the whoosh. I think that was a big contribution to cable. And, but I think that our voices are not heard. And I just want, and by the way, there were, you know, there were pro-life voices on TV before. Remember Ralph Reed? He used to get on TV every once in a while. I just believe that it is time that those of us who are liberal, I'm a DLC Democrat, but Paul Wellstone was someone I loved, but he wasn't, you know, I disagreed with him a lot, and I like bringing people together, and I have a lot of Republican friends. I do. No, really, honest. And but I just think that I think what I do does civilize the discourse, because I think you just have to call people on it and call people on their incivility. And if they know there are watchdogs out there who are saying, you can't say that. You can't get away with that.
Now, excuse me, but the title of your book is Liar, Liar, Big Liar, and you're advancing the cause of civility. Is that what I'm getting here?
Well, first of all, that's not the title of my book, but you came close.
It's unbelievable, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm glad you're all here to see it.
Anyway, you know, the thing is, Bill, if you kept saying the thing about that's all you got after 6 years, and then you complained about how long I went on. If you want me to go on for several hours, I can go into some other stuff. But the point is that I was trying to make is that there are people on the right, especially, who are so vituperatives, who are Grover Norquist, who said basically bipartisan, what Molly Ivins was about to say is that he said bipartisanship is date rape. That's what he said. And I think that there's a place for a voice. There are voices. Molly's one of them. Molly's a great one. But there is a place to call people on things. And that's what I do. And I think that does increase civility. And the name of the book is not what you said, it's lies and the lying liars who tell them a fair and balanced look at the right.
And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I think it is time that we thank our authors, thank our audience, and life goes on.